Hi, this is Icon Art Radio. I'm Bill Teeple. I'm here with co-host Alan Cobb. And once again, we have Greg Thatcher sitting in. We were looking at each other and saying, why do we do these things? Why did he... We had a show talking about the history of trying to create an interface of art here in Fairfield. And Greg was the original founder of the ICA, the Institute of Creative Art. And I, of course, have done ICON, Iowa Contemporary Art, which are vehicles through which the public can interface with a lot of the great art being made here. And we looked at each other and said, why do we do these things? Why do we do these things? What drives us? Because I'll stay up all night not getting paid to mount a show. And there's two things. I want people to be able to experience this stuff, but I also am satisfying myself. In many cases, the hanging of the show is my art form.
Absolutely.
And I'm always never satisfied. There's always never enough time, but I'm satisfied enough that I'll say, raise the curtain, basically, you know. It's 6:30, the art walk night, and we're opening a show.
Yeah, and I can guarantee you, you were right there, you still have your nail bag on, and you're, putting things up right up to the last minute, and then you're continuing to fiddle with things while the people are coming, oh, Bill, this is such a wonderful show, and it's like, no, you're just off doing things, because I would do the same thing.
Can't talk to you right now. I'm putting little numbers up on the wall.
I'm too busy.
Because there's a kind of perfection that we're trying to achieve that is our reward.
Yes,
you know, getting it right, whether nobody sees it, is the reward. And then the fact that you're going to give this to people as a gift is the other reward. Yeah. So there's both things involved. Yeah. But I guess that's what drives artists all together, because they'll live in garrets and forget to eat for the plus that comes out of a little piece of perfection getting manifest in life.
Yeah.
Because life is so chaotic. I mean, there's so much going on. I mean, just think about visual information and how many bits of visual information are we receiving every day? So, you know, millions and millions and millions. So in this little situation that we've got balance, we've created something. There's some unity there. There's some balance there. There's some greater meaning that comes out of that balance. That's art.
Right. But that's rectangle or square, that a small perfection.
But I'm saying in the exhibit.
Oh, the exhibit.
In the exhibit.
Oh, yeah, same thing.
Is the same thing. That this space, with all this work and the way it's all been organized and the way it's been balanced and the way we've thought our way through it and everything we've done, that's an artwork.
Right, and then the person walks in. It's an installation, really, but it's a collaborative installation. The person walks in and the person's awareness is readjusted to perfection, to a kind of perfection.
That's right.
When they walk out of the museum or the gallery, they're a chain. They are a work of art that has been changed.
Rearranged,
And that's the value of art in society. It's a very amazing thing that we have this in culture.
Yeah.
We are fighting against entropy.
Well, we are, and that's what the artist is doing, is a soldier on the battlefield of
entropy.
Order.
Yeah. Bringing it's order very to interesting entropy. To think the culturally where we are right now and how children are brought up, or how we were brought up, and how much the television played a role. And, you know, now you have computers and everybody has a cell phone, and now your cell phone, you can do anything on the cell phone, so you can be connected up and do anything. And people are walking around with their, you know, it's got a color screen on it, they're watching movies, they're talking to their friends, they're chatting, they're doing all this. There's all this that's going on, but the speed of information is so quick that what I've like to think about, or have kind of noticed, is that, you know, for somebody to be quiet, to enjoy, to really get looking at an artwork, it's becoming more difficult.
Yeah. Definitely.
It's becoming more difficult because the level of excitation, for lack of a better word, is always kind of going on. People are vibrating at such a high level, if you want to think about it in that way. To get him to come into a museum and to let all that go. I mean, it'd be nice if you could say, leave your cell phone here and then go into the museum.
Yeah.
And I'll give you an example of that. This was really completely blew me away. I was in the Chicago Art Institute. And this is before they had done the new wing. And I love Brancusi's work. Absolutely adore his work. And there's one called the Black Negris that's there. And it's this little fish. And I mean, it's just mind-blowingly gorgeous. Mm-hmm. Just I just sit there, just I'm entranced with the piece. And I like to go in there and kind of just sit to the side, you know, sit at the doorway or something and just kind of watch. And there was some young guy, a guy and his girl were walking around in there. And all of a sudden, he was standing by the piece, and all of a sudden he got a phone call. So he's chatting on the phone, and here's this artwork there. And I had this experience, it's like, the artwork has more unity, more coherence than the person. And that was like, wait a minute. It completely changed the way that I start looking at human beings and also looking at artwork, because it was way more powerful. Yeah. The coherence that existed in the artwork, the beauty. And then you come up with the question, you know, but this is a human being and they're alive and they can... But look at the... You know, it was always coming back to that, looking at the artwork.
And that, but that artwork is the encapsulation of the expanded and coherent state of consciousness of the artist.
That's right.
And it's held there a battery, and it radiates it.
That's right.
But just standing next to it doesn't mean
that
will be absorbed and taken on by the viewer. That's a it's participation that creates the...
So it was interesting. It was an interesting thing that I keep thinking about that and bringing it up as an example. But it's right. Because, you know, you go into that space and you look at that and it's perfect. You know, it's absolutely perfect. So if you can be simple in your awareness and look at, then you will get all that. That will come into you. You know, you'll take that in. You'll digest it. It'll become part of your being, you know, part of the way that you think, that beauty. And so it's so profound. Yeah. It's so profound, but you have to give it time. You know, you have to participate in it.
And we were talking about teaching the last time we got together. Mm. And the students are different today than they were 10 years ago.
Yeah.
And I, having come, you know, being my age, I know that my background and what everything that I'm structured in as an individual... it's a different world than a kid that was born in 1990 and the world that they've grown up in. These kids like are multitasking constantly. Mm-hmm. They've got 10 things going at once, and they seem to be able to, that seems to be their means of progressing and learning.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so getting them to sit and look at one thing for any limit, for any amount of time.
It's difficult.
Is difficult.
Yeah.
And,
It's such a joy when they get it.
Yeah, and that's what we provide with our, you know, with what we're doing as art teachers.
Yeah. And that's the value.
And that's what the museum is providing. Yeah. That's what these works of art are providing.
And that's the value.
We don't want to lose that.
No, no. And, you know, money doesn't touch that. You know, money, you know, it's having that experience, sharing that experience with a student is really, really valuable.
Yeah.
It's very, very valuable.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, it's a spiritual thing, really. It really is.
Absolutely.
And, you know, once they get it, then it's, oh, yeah, they got it. You know, they got it. So it's a wonderful experience. Wonderful experience.
So. I wonder if my sound work isn't, in a sense, trying to foster that, because I do these sound compositions that involve very little of what we traditionally think of as music, melody, harmony, rhythm. And I'm trying to explore the subtle timbres that are achievable now with wonderful new technology. And I'm trying to explore the even subtler domains where we achieve spatial experiences due to microscopic variations in timing and the vibrations and so on. But in order to get anything like the experience that I'm exploring, you have to be willing to, with headphones or with a reasonably decent music system, stop doing other things and allow your attention to go into this sound field. And you can't be answering the phone and talking to people and reading a magazine and watching. There are actually a couple of painters in town who play this same material while they're painting. Because it's so non-patterned. It's non-structured. I mean, there is a structure, it's one carefully built not to be...
obvious.
Not to be repetitive unless I'm making a point. I mean, there are actually a couple of them that are in sonata form. And there's a theme, but the theme has to do with the way the space and the texture change. And then if the space and the texture change that way again, that's repeating the theme, but with a variation. So that's B and so on. But it's like you walk into a gallery full of paintings and you could just walk by them all and say, yep, that's what's in here now, and walk right on out the door. And an awful lot of people do that. Mm-hmm. They say, well, there's nothing in here that grabs me. And even if they do like art, they may still just walk in, take a quick look, and walk out.
Some people actually, all they really want to do is walk in and categorize it and identify it.
Right,
and then they've got what they need to know.
Right,
and then
put it in a basket.
But that's an interesting thing that I've spent a lot of time thinking about. Because our brain is that way.
Yeah.
You know, that our subconscious likes it. It's the one that's running quite a bit of the show.
Yeah.
And so if there's a little category for something and we feel safe, then it's like, okay. So I know what that is, I'll just move on.
And
if I know what that is, I'll move on.
That's what my sound work strives to deal with. Because I divide sound into music, speech, referential sound, which is sounds that refer to something, and everything else.
Right.
And sounds of the fourth kind are where I'm trying to stay, which doesn't give the brain anything much to work with in terms of putting everything in categories. And so the brain either conjures up some fanciful thing to explain the sound, to be the origin of the sound.
To identify.
Yeah.
To identify.
To be the source of the sound, in a sense. Or it just gives up and sort of flops around, and all this categorization components of the brain can settle down. Speech center can turn off. The various sections that deal with music, which are not the speech center, they're scattered all around the brain. Many of them can also turn off. There may be no trace of rhythm, no trace of repeating patterns. And so even the recognition process is relatively simplified. And if you're willing to go have that experience, it's rather interesting. And some people find it extremely refreshing to stop thinking, in a sense, about stuff and just experience it.
Yeah, there's the same thing with when you look at paintings. And a lot of times...
Rothko.
Yeah, I love Rothko's work.
Yeah.
But a lot of people have a lot of problem because it goes back to this thing about identification.
Right, right.
So
it's a blob.
Well, no, there isn't anything that's recognizable in the picture.
Right.
Excuse me. So therefore... I'm scared, or they don't think they're scared, but I'm not going to go there. So if there's some little thread that's in there that's recognizable, and if you allow I tell my students to just let your attention be loose, then you'll go in.
Yeah.
And then once you're in to the picture, then the artist, through repetition or whatever, you know, color or whatever, however they balance everything that they're doing, will move your attention around through the picture, and then hopefully you'll get the result. But you were saying that it's also about discovery.
Right.
Because when you're in the picture, then you'll be looking at it, and then all of a sudden it's, oh, then you'll remember right. things that have happened to you in the past. And so that's that wellspring of the, deeper, it's not the big S of self-referral, but it's a self-referral system that you'll, this is like that and like this, and I remember Auntie Betty doing this, or, all that information starts coming up.
Yeah.
And you're looking at a picture, but all this information from you is coming up, which then makes it's interesting, because it's not a spectator sport anymore. A lot of times, very realistic artwork, it's a spectator sport. It's all done for you, look at it, it's all done, finished. But if it's not, it's a little, has some marriage between abstraction and realism. Then the you become enlivened by virtue of the artwork. It's a whole different situation.
Yeah.
Whole different situation. Much richer. Much richer.
Oh, yeah.
Much richer. But you have to be, you have to be simple. You have to let your attention be loose to look at it. Or otherwise, you get stuck because your brain is telling you, this is not something that I know of. I'm going to turn it off. I'm going to go to something that I know.
And the brain spends most of its time filtering out all of the stuff that we don't recognize so that we only experience the things that we already recognize.
That's right.
To get something in one of those chinks where the brain isn't expecting that there's something that we haven't recognized that we also will experience is kind of a miracle. And when you think about how the senses work, what's happening in vision or hearing, the experience inside is nothing like what's happening to the sensors, the eyes and the ears.
Right.
It's almost unrelated to what's happening physically. And if we're totally comfortable with this fantasy that's been built for us, the room is so square and perfectly rectangular, but that's not what's happening on the inside of your eyeball. The stuff going on the retina is so distorted and constantly changing, and the foreshortening in perspective is constantly all filled with distortions, and we just don't see any of that. We glance around the room and, gee, it stays the same for me. Even though it's not even close to being the same. If you just look through a camera and wave it around a little bit, you see what chaos is going on inside your eyeball that's completely...
Yeah, it's kind of like when you look at Picasso, and when Picasso was coming up with cubism, you try to explain to students, how did he do that? Because our vision and our brain is compensating. If I move a little bit this way, I move a little bit this way, I turn my head that way, I turn my head. We compensate for it, because if we didn't compensate for it, you'd start feeling sick.
Yeah.
You would actually feel it. So I said what they did is they would take one point of view, and then they take another point of view, and another point of view, and they put them all together.
Yeah.
So it's a much deeper way of appreciating and understanding. Mm-hmm. But it was very confusing to people because it's like, what's going on? What are these guys, crazy? Can't they paint?
Yeah.
Look at this. It's just madness.
Noses and eyes and lips
all this together.
But it is more the way we actually take things in.
That's right. Yeah.
And it's many wonderfully reminiscent of the kid's drawing of the airplane with one wing that goes straight up and one wing that goes straight down, and a profile of the fuselage with the vertical stabilizer.
It's interesting you bring up about little children, because, and I don't know if you've taught any little tiny ones, but little children, if you remember back to when you were a kid, a line is a snake, it's a road, it's your mother, it's a cloud, it's everything. It's everything.
Yeah.
And then when you move into around age 8, 9, or 10, and the brain starts to function differently, then you start to begin to categorize.
Yeah.
And then you see, this line, that's just a line, that's not my mother. And this stick figure, that's not my dad.
Yeah,
it's a stick figure. Like it doesn't look like them, so they stop making art. They stop that creative process because it doesn't match with what they think it should be. Mm-hmm. Which is a crime in a way, but that's just the way that the brain works. So our job as art teachers is to try to encourage them to enliven that sort of deeper areas in themselves and be more open, be more flexible, be able to have it be many more things than just exactly what you see. And it's much more fun anyway.
Yeah.
It's much more fun because, again, it's your discovery, it's a sense of discovery, which then nourishes you. And hopefully that will encourage you that the next time that when you're looking at something and you discover it, you know, if that continues, then you...
So is the reason that you do this, as we started the show, because of the pleasure you get getting through to
people? That's a good question.
Or is it because of the pleasure you get just getting that installation the way it has to be?
I think it's even deeper than that.
Yeah.
I don't think we have a choice.
That may well be.
There is no choice. And I'm sure you probably would say the same thing. You just, that's who you are, and that's what you do.
What you do.
So you don't waste your time questioning about it. It's just you do it because that's what you, that's what your job is. Or that, not in the sense of your job, but that's what you're, I don't know.
The artist is sort of like a, it's like a religious calling or like a prophet or something. It's just you don't have much, you don't choose it like as a job that will
bring you money.
A living. No, you never, I mean, some people
it's
do, and they become decorators and they become illustrators and they use this skill to make a living. But the true artist really has no control over it. He can't help but do it.
Well, in a way, I do it because if I don't do it, I get punished. You know, I get really, really unhappy.
Yeah, and that's it. That's it.
So that's why we do it.
That's from my life.
And when, you know, I tell my students, if you start, if you notice that if you're not making artwork, that you're not as happy, I said, then you are an artist. Mm-hmm. So just go with it. You don't know how it's going to turn out. You don't know where, you know, where it's going, but you have no choice. Yeah. That this is what you are meant to be doing.
Yeah.
So you should just do that.
And if you fight it, you'll be sorry.
Yeah, if you fight it and you try to make money, or you fight it, or you try to do this, then, you know, you've sold your soul out and you're an unhappy person and you basically you've wasted your life.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it is a calling. It is, you know, something, but, you know, it's you just...
You don't choose to do it. You can't help yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I remember the first time my mother, I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. I hadn't a clue, you know, and she put up an easel and she said, you should just do some painting. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I can still see the pain in it. It was really bad. This is kind of...
Give her a prize, though, for doing that.
But it was wonderful because, you know, I was doing something and there was this feeling that, this is it. You know, this is what I should be doing.
Yeah.
I just changed. At that point, I just changed. Stopped taking the classes that I was taking in school, and I just jumped over to the art department, and everything's changed since that point, and it just continues.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm understanding it more, you know, and I can appreciate it more, and there's more happiness that comes from it, but it still goes right back to that same thing.
I'm laughing because I remember one of the last things my mother said to me in that general direction, which was, why can't you get a regular job like, you know, an accountant? And I couldn't think of where to begin to explain why a regular job wasn't going to quite cut it. It was something. One of the problems she had was that she couldn't explain what I was doing because it was complicated.
Can you explain what you're doing?
No,
ironically, there were times when I actually had a job that she should have been happy with, but it was hard to explain also.
Yeah.
And it meant that, you know, for someone, maybe her generation more than ours, not being able to explain it in a word to certain people whose approval she craved meant that they would go on thinking, we don't really know what Louise's son is doing.
He's one of those weirdos. You know,
he isn't making it. He's not.
No, we are. I think in this group, in this town, I think most people have this history.
I suppose, or at least in in a certain age group. But that was, I guess that was, you know, I grew up in the 50s, and it was, the neighbors were, even though we hardly had any neighbors, they were really important. Mm-hmm. What they thought or would think if they existed was tremendously important. And as it was, you couldn't even see another house from our house, but they were out there
somewhere
lurking. And if someone discovered that, a friend of mine and I, we were working in Vermont, we drove home during the Christmas holidays and stopped at his house to visit his mother, and the next day she chewed him out six ways from Sunday. And we were in our mid-20s, and we were gainfully employed, and we worked in Vermont. And this was in New Jersey. It turned out that what was bothering her, and it took quite a while to get this out, was the fact that his car was parked in front of her house on a weekday, and that meant he was a bum. He was nothing but a bum. In their neighborhood, if somebody's son was not at work at any time, Monday through Friday, he was unemployed, and that meant he was probably had something wrong. Maybe he's an alcoholic, maybe he's on drugs, but one way or another, he's in a bad place if he's not at work.
Yeah, interesting.
But let me bring this back to the to our art consideration. The art can't really be explained because it's so like life itself. Mm-hmm. It is life itself that we're delivering. It's the meaning of life itself, but you can't put your finger on it quite. And that's why the first thing that's eliminated when the funds run out in public funding and stuff is the arts, because even though it is what delivers the most to everyone, because without any art activity, everyone would, it would just be a machine with no soul. It's still, you can't quite explain it.
Right.
And therefore it, we can know that the reading, writing, and arithmetic, and the building, the bridges, and all of these things are just tangible things we can see and we need to support. But so it's very nebulous. So let me just say before we end that we've been talking to Greg Thatcher one more time, who is now teaching at MSAE, is a well-known teacher, and it was so nice to have him.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.